Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today our guest is Tommy Orange, author of There, There, published just last week by Knopf. Tommy's a recent graduate of the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's a 2014 McDowell Colony Fellow and a 2016 Writing by Writers Fellow. He's also an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. There, There is an ensemble book. In some ways, for those of you who are old enough to remember, reminds me of movies like by Robert Altman, like Nashville, where you have all this large cast of characters seemingly unrelated at the outset to the other, but as the book progresses, their paths begin to cross, and they edge closer and closer to each other until the reader recognizes the total connection between each and every one of them. The most difficult thing about this process for a writer is holding each of these people, the reader, in your head, and then clearly seeing and following the paths they take. And this is what Tommy Orange has accomplished so well in There, There. This cast of characters, an aspiring documentary filmmaker, a boy who teaches himself traditional Native American dance by watching YouTube, another morbidly obese man lost in his own challenges. Well, I guess they're all lost in their own challenges. And these are just a couple of the 12, really over 12 characters that propel this book to its final an overwhelming climax. So welcome, Tommy, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So how did this overriding concept of a group of Native Americans converging on a powwow in Oakland first come about in your head?
So it actually came all of a sudden and sort of complete. I thought of it. I was driving down to L.A. With my wife, and we just found out that she was pregnant, and I'd known I wanted to work on a novel for a while, but I didn't have the idea, and it just popped into my head. And the basic concept was I was going to write all these different characters whose lives converged at a powwow, and I was convinced enough of the idea to write into it for the next 6 or 7 years.
The characters, and I've read a lot of interviews with you, seem. Some of them are, you've actually acknowledged that they all have some resemblance to you, not only from the way they sound, but because I've read in your interview that, like, Thomas Frank, for example, seems to be the closest to you in that resemblance, right?
I don't know. I don't know where I've said the most, but I don't think that it's the most, actually. But maybe him and Dean Oxendine, they share some biographical details with me, but so does Orville. Like I said, they all do. I think the Thomas Frank one, because of the way I started out, it's talking about where I come from, who my parents were. Those are just straight up biographical details that I write about in the voice of Thomas Frank in the second person. I think that's maybe the reason why. And, my name is Thomas Frank Orange, my actual full name.
Huh.
But I go by Tommy.
Well, talking about second person, which is a difficult way to write, how did you go about, and what was the thought process between switching from first to third and then even to second, as you said?
I did a lot of experimentation with POV, with all the characters. They all experienced some kind of transposition into a different POV when I was trying to figure out what sounded the most like the way I wanted them to sound. And when you have this many characters, you really want to be careful to make sure they're distinct. And POV, changing the POV of a character can really, it's maybe even a way of cheating a little, give them more distinction than just the way you're writing sentences and what details I include about them. POV is enough of a difference that when you're switching characters, you're not confusing two characters because there's a couple different things happening. There's the way I write the sentences and then, the angle at which you're coming to find out about the character.
The title is especially evocative, and I know, again, from reading about you, that, Gertrude Stein wrote about Oakland, that there is no there there. But what was fascinating to me, and you intimated sometimes, is that early on in the book you refer to Radiohead's song, There, There. And, I listened to it a couple times after I read the book, and how did that tie in, because that is also a very evocative song, and the video too.
The video is a little bit too 90s for me to get into, but there are words. you know, it was somewhat serendipitous that the song lyrics actually fit, like, you know, we are accidents waiting to happen. This sort of could be a tagline for what, you know, what happens in the book. And just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there is another lyric from There, There. And that could be described as, you know, people's search for their identity and the doubt that whether or not, I mean, maybe they feel native, but the doubt creeping in, saying maybe just because you feel that you are, maybe you're not. That was totally serendipitous. You know, I came to the There, There title from the Gertrude Stein quote, and then I love Radiohead, and I found out that it was a song. I'd missed it somehow. The title name, anyway, because, you know, we don't have CDs anymore where you, like, look at the album artwork and look at all the names. I had Hail to the Thief. That's what album it's on.
Right.
And I don't always know titles to songs, or I just didn't notice it, because I love that album. I just never noticed it until I thought of the title, and then it became perfect to use as, you know, one of the characters listening to that song at the beginning of the book.
And, you know, the other thing that I really like and I like talking about is epigraphs. And you use epigraphs at really interesting times in the book, and you use people that, you know, aren't really necessarily, you never think of them in terms of their relationship to Native Americans. But if we go through those, if you don't mind it, like you, the first one, you know, Bertolt Brecht and singing about the dark times. What made you think about that in terms of the book? And how did that come about? Because it's such a, it's so arcane and eclectic, but it does really tie to the narrative.
I can't remember exactly. There's a lot of stuff that I came across doing research that I don't remember when or how I came across things. But that one particularly, I knew that was going to be the epigraph to the beginning of the book, because not only because it feels like we live in dark times now.
Hell yeah.
But just in regards to Native people, we live in a different world than a lot of people. You know, we come from harder lived lives, and we've, like, terrible things have happened to our families, and that plays out over history in our own lives in ways that other people don't know about. So, and the book is a kind of like singing about the dark times itself.
And then maybe the most difficult to wrap your head around is, again, Gertrude Stein and this idea in that epigraph of a feather being cohesive, and the feather once again being evocative of the American Indian. That epigraph was very moving, but it's hard to explain what it actually means.
That's how I would describe most of Gertrude Stein's work.
But it was a good one to pick, because it really made you, you know, like all good poetry, it made you think and it made you ponder, but you couldn't really explain it to anybody. And that's how I thought.
Yeah. I like that keeps the mystery. And I also like that it's speaking to, like, how does one thing form? It forms from all these unlikely things, and it gets its definition from other unlikely things. And the characters all being put in context of one another as a collective kind of creates the one thing, the singular vision.
And it may be that I feel like I'm going astray because of these epigraphs, but I think they really do tie back to the book. Obviously they do, especially when you talk about, from James Baldwin, about history being a two-way trap. And how does that relate to the plight, if you will, of the Native American?
Well, it's, you know, it's speaking to how history plays out. You know, there's a term that people use sometimes, historical trauma. And you'll hear a lot of non-Native people, especially white people, say, have a sentiment like, get over it, that happened so long ago. But anybody who's from an oppressed community knows the way history plays out over time, and it's not something that doesn't affect you just because it's in the past, and it lives in you, and you are sort of trapped in it, especially because we haven't really faced, in a serious way, we haven't looked at the origins of this country. We haven't reconciled with it. We still are trying to paint it as if no one was here, and we sort of marched across with our heads held high, nobly naming things and you know, plunging flags into the ground, as if there was not bloodshed throughout that.
But you know, the other thing, and I'll skip over. You know, there were other the epigraph by Jean Genet and Baudelaire, but. I was interested in reading in the interviews about the authors that helped you along the way. Borges, which is magical realism, Kafka, which is the absurd and sometimes tragic, and then my favorite book of all time, Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. But none of them seem to, like, mesh with this particular book, yet they kind of do in a way. And it's really interesting that those are the three authors, and Sylvia Plath, too, that kind of influenced you as you grew up.
Yeah, I mean, those things were what made me fall in love. Those books particularly made me fall in love with literature in general.
Me too.
So there's that overall influence. And they also made me want to write. But as far as books that influenced this book, I would say it's more something like Let the Great World Spin was a big influence.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad.
I interviewed her on
Roberto
that.
Roberto Bolaño's Savage Detectives. The books that I inspired the structure and the thinking around how I would handle it. Brief History of Seven Killings by Mylon James.
Mm-hmm.
I reference the other ones because it's the beginning of me falling in love with literature. The ones that influenced this book are different ones.
You know, when I was reading the book also, for moments, or even chapters, I forgot I was reading a book about Native Americans because the themes, the characters seemed so familiar to me as an old white man, to so many of the thoughts and actions that I've experienced or read about in other contexts. So I think that's kind of cool in a way that you were able to do that. Did you see that?
I think that there is a certain kind of magic where the more specific you get, the more universal it is.
Huh.
This is something that I learned teaching non-writers to write. I did digital storytelling work for many years. And when trying to get people to tell their stories who don't normally tell their stories or who haven't had an opportunity to tell their stories, the first thing they tend to do is generalize. And the general tends to be not personal and not universal. And the more you can get people to talk about the details, what was the scene like, what are the specifics that only you could talk about, the more universal it would feel and the more powerful the story would feel. I applied that to my own writing. I tried to really get specific and carve out characters that felt real. And you know, Native people often are dehumanized and not, and you know, one-dimensional and historical. So in writing these characters, I really wanted to make them contemporary feeling and real feeling and have the range of human experience just like anybody else. And it's sad to have to, you know, to say that that we have to, like, make these claims to just to get to the base level. But in some ways, I believe it's true.
Yeah, I think that's a great part of the book, that you can read it. And, I mean, I know there's a message to it that's specific to your situation and the situation of a lot of people that you feel towards. But I think it's really great that you can read it in a way that it applies to the entire human race, whether you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we go to write, there are ways that we are more the same than we are different as humans.
Yeah, I think that's
so
great.
I wanted to do both things. I did have a Native audience in mind, so I'm happy that other people connect to it.
Yeah, and I guess part of what you did was a lot like Dean Oxendane, because if you're listening to people's stories, which what he was doing, and he was trying to stay out of listening to, you know, stay away from them so they could tell their own story. Yeah, I guess you are a lot like him in that way. So getting down to, like, the mechanics of the book, it would be so hard, and it seems so hard for an author, and I know authors who have tried to do it and don't accomplish it, but when you set out all of these, this dozen, this or baker's dozen, since there's more with the kids. When you set out all these people, how did you do it, like an outline, like a storyboard or something like that? Because they came together in such a beautiful way into an amazing ending. How did you go about doing that?
In the middle, it gets really messy and rough. I mean, in the middle of writing this, I went through a hard period of not knowing what I was doing or how I was going to come out of it. There was a sense that I could get stuck in the middle and then have to abandon the whole thing because I couldn't figure it out how to do it. Running was a big part of figuring out some of the deeper solutions and connections. So it was when I was away from the computer and not thinking and not trying to force an answer out where something would just occur to me that would make it, where it would just be a detail about one of the characters that would connect to another character that would make it feel more interwoven. And so during that middle period, you know, I figured out a lot of things about structure and about how they all related to each other. And I had the guiding light of they're all going to end up at the powwow and how, and that helped a lot as well.
Well, going to the powwow, because you describe it very well, but for most of us, we don't know what the real meaning, the deep meaning is of a powwow. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that in the time we have left?
I mean, it means something different for everybody. Depending on your experience with a powwow. For some people, it means they travel the whole summer and try to win prize money for dancing or for hand drum. For other people, they're selling their jewelry. For some people, they're just going to watch the dancers and to be around Native people and to get an Indian taco. There is no meaning. It's kind of, you know, I like that it's intertribal. All these different tribes come together, and that's not something that often happens outside of a powwow. But the meaning is variable depending on who you are, and there's something for everybody there. So I'm definitely not the voice on what powwows mean, or you'd have to ask a range of different types of Native people.
Yeah,
what a powwow means to them.
It's like the Burning Man festival almost. You know, it's like it means something different for everybody, but it does seem like there's a certain. It definitely did in the book seem like there was a certain spiritual aspect to it that, without giving anything away or spoilers, was deeply affected by what happens at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, in any event, I felt that that was, the way you led to that almost point from this vast array of characters, I did definitely think that was really well done. And
thank you.
And the other thing, and I know you have to go because it's almost 3 o'clock. But I own an independent bookstore, and your book will be out on the front table. And and the last person I interviewed, as soon as I started talking, the last person I interviewed, as soon as I started talking to her, I said something. And she goes, "Oh yeah, that's like the new book by Tommy Orange. There's all kinds of buzz about that book," and I thought that was kind of cool to tell you because apparently there's a lot of buzz, and authors know what's going on, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, the buzz is pretty overwhelming. I don't even know how to react to it anymore.
Yeah, I can only imagine because I can't imagine that you expected this, but like it's like I said in the introduction, it's very cinematic. So I'm sure something will happen, and you'll be optioned, and maybe it will become a movie, and movie with that can be populated by real Native Americans.
That'd be great. Yeah, that would be a dream come true. I'm a big fan of movies.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tommy. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. You too.
We were talking with Tommy Orange about his new book, There, which is populated by this vast array of characters that somehow they start out like miles and miles apart, but then at the end they all come together, and he does it in such a way that it's seamless. I don't know how he did it, but it's really a good book. It's really different. It's about Native Americans, yet it has an appeal to everybody. It's very cinematic. it's, as I said to him, got a lot of buzz. Who knows? It might win Book of the Year award. It might win the Orange Prize. It might win something, just like when I interviewed Rachel Kushner on The Flamethrowers. Same thing. It won the National Book Award Prize. So anyway, it was a pleasure talking to him, and I highly recommend the book, There, There, Tommy Orange. So I look forward to you joining us every week on the Avid Reader Show. Once again, Rebecca, the producer of this show for many, many years, has come up with some great upcoming authors. Will Mackin is going to be here to share his debut short story collection. I love short story collections. Bring Out the Dog Stories. It's about his 23-year stint in the Navy and his experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's fascinating. It's autobiographical to a certain extent, but it's clearly fiction in another. But it really makes you think, and it really makes you, gives you two diametric views of what the war was like, what these two wars were like that still go on in many senses. And then we will be talking to Abdi Noor Iftin, who's going to discuss his debut memoir, which is Call Me American, which is an amazing story about how this little kid escaped Somalia, ended up in Mogadishu, then Little Mogadishu, which is the refugee camp, and then won the green card lottery, all while he was conversing with Americans on This American Life and NPR. It's just a fascinating story about this miracle of how he got to America. And scores of other authors, but lots of other authors that you'll listen to in upcoming weeks. But the main thing is, thanks as always for joining us here on The Avid Reader.